The avian flu, it's now making its way into wild and domestic bird populations in Europe, the Middle East, Africa. This week, the virus showed up in a cat in Germany, the first time it's appeared in a mammal in Europe, and it's spreading very rapidly into 14 new countries in the last month. It spread into France, and for the first time, it showed up in a captive population of birds, which I'm sure is worrying health officials now. Also, how could it got into a closed population? It is alarming public health officials who are worried. Of course, the great worry is that it could become a major human pandemic if it mutates into a form that can be transmitted easily between people. That has not happened yet, but people are worried that it will take a major effort to contain the virus if that happens, especially in places that lack adequate public health systems. Well, that effort got a bit of a boost earlier this year when donors at a Beijing conference on avian and human influenza pledged nearly $2 billion to fight the disease. So what is the state of the animal pandemic? Are countries prepared to deal with it? What is the best way to head off the spread of the virus? There is a plan out in this week's issue of the journal Nature for a network of labs like those run by the U.S. military to track the disease in places least able to handle an outbreak, but maybe the places where this outbreak might show up first. So we're going to talk about avian flu update this hour for the rest of the hour in this segment, 1-800-989-8255. You're more than welcome to give us a call. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. David Nabarro is the Senior United Nations Systems Coordinator for Avian and Human Influenza at the UN Development Group in New York. He joins us today by phone. Welcome to the program, Dr. Nabarro.
Hello. How do you do? It's good to be with you.
Thank you. Dr. Jean-Paul Chrétien is the Coordinator of Overseas Research Laboratories for the Department of Defense Global Emerging Infections, Surveillance and Response System at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Silver Spring. He joins us by phone from his lab there. Welcome to the program, Lieutenant. Oh,
hello. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Nabarro, let me ask you this. The spread of the flu to the chickens in France and the cat in Germany, is this particularly worrisome?
Well, I say that this is certainly disturbing to see the speed at which this virus is spreading across the world. Generally, I wouldn't want to particularly single out Europe. I think we've seen really big transformations in the epidemiology with the virus in West Africa, in the Middle East, in Iraq and Egypt, and also in the Indian subcontinent. The infection of a cat is itself not surprising because cats eat birds, and so this cat seems to have picked up an infection from eating a dead bird, but we have to be watchful at all times for the spread across species. This time it's from bird to mammal into the cat, and if we get more reports of infected cats, that will certainly also be a cause for concern, Ira.
Mm-hmm. What is the single biggest hurdle you have as a public health official in keeping track of the disease and watching it spread?
Well, for me, the major challenge that I face all the time is having access to the best possible data on where the infection is. And the difficulty here is that we don't always have data made available promptly on specimens as soon as the infection or sickness is discovered. And so the point you made at the beginning of the show about the possible value of a network of laboratories is well taken. The second continuing challenge we face is, of course, the more animal virus or bird virus there is around in the world, the greater the chance cumulatively of the change that you described taking place in the pandemic starting.
So having a way of following and tracking the spread is of critical importance.
Indeed. We do have a network of laboratories that do reference testing available. And that's, of course, very important to help absolutely confirm what's going on. But the interval so often between first detection of a die-off and then the confirmation is quite long. And it's in that interval that the infection spreads amongst the poultry in the affected location. So the quicker we can get the diagnosis, the better.
You said in an interview last fall that if the bird flu gets into Africa, then we've got a big problem on our hands. That has happened. Why is avian flu in Africa such a problem?
Well, the capacity in many countries to bring influenza in and birds under control is always stretched, especially if veterinary services are quite limited. The particular challenge in very poor countries is that people really don't want to have chickens culled in the when you get the infection, and they won't only accept if you can provide prompt compensation payments. And the logistics of organising this is very difficult. In fact, Nigeria has been pretty well organised, but there are other much poorer countries in Africa where this kind of situation would be very, very hard to handle indeed.
Do you feel that countries are taking this seriously enough and are preparing themselves? Even here in the United States, there was testimony by Julia Gerberding yesterday in Congress that even the U.S. is only half prepared, much more prepared than it used to be, but still only half prepared.
Well, you and I both know that you can't be fully prepared for something unless you've been through an exercise in which you actually test out what challenges it poses. And I think for many governments, the sudden arrival of bird flu is very testing for national authorities. They just haven't experienced in advance the kind of the panic that's often associated with it. So I'd like to suggest that more and more countries and governments and organizations actually simulate what would happen first when the bird flu arrives and secondly when the pandemic starts.
Dr. Nabarro, I'm going to let you go. I know you're on a train, and I think this is our first interview from a train on Science Friday.
I'm sorry I'm not with you, but it's very nice to be talking to you and your audience. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Dr. David Nabarro is Senior United Nations Systems Coordinator for Avian and Human Influenza at the UN Developmental Group in New York. Dr. Chrétien, tell us about we were talking about the need to have sort of an early warning system for the breakout of this disease. You were talking about in a paper that it's possible that we could imitate a military model for setting up stations to track the disease, or actually resurrect that tracking system.
That's right. The U.S. military has been interested in infectious diseases overseas for a long time, and it has five overseas medical research laboratories currently. They're in Peru, Egypt, Kenya, Thailand, and Indonesia. And what they do is research on infectious diseases that is important for the military, such as trials of vaccines and drugs and other interventions for these diseases, but also tracking these diseases, helping these countries that they work in and other countries in the area establish surveillance systems so they can get that data from the ground in a timely manner, as Dr. Nabarro discussed. Get that data into the public health authorities who can take action and stop outbreaks before they become national problems, regional problems, or in the case of influenza, possibly a global pandemic.
Mm-hmm. In your paper in Nature, you propose this worldwide network of tracking stations. Are there stations that already exist that are going to be downsized or taken off that could be saved for this worldwide network?
Well, speaking just for the five military labs, there's no plan to downsize or close those facilities. But there is a larger network of labs, and Dr. Nabarro alluded to this as well. It's a network run by the World Health Organization, and what the WHO does is tries to link up existing institutions and experts so that if a lab in a certain area identifies what it thinks may be a problem, they can call on this wider network for help. And the U.S. military's facilities are important parts of this network, and what we're proposing is that countries may want to consider establishing similar facilities based on this military model in areas where the WHO network does not currently extend, and in areas where if there were human-to-human transmission of a pandemic strain of influenza, we might not catch it in time.
Mm-hmm. Give us an idea of what that network might look like and where you would put the laboratories.
Well, the labs themselves, we think, could look much like the military's research laboratories overseas now. And there are a couple of important features of those labs. One is that they are flexible and they're broad-based and able to work on a range of infectious disease problems. We're very concerned about avian influenza now and the threat of a pandemic. And from the beginning of my organization's work in infectious diseases, the Global Emerging Infection System, influenza has been the top priority. But in any given area, we don't know what the most important emerging infectious disease tomorrow is going to be. We don't know what new diseases will appear. And so we have to have labs that are able to work on a wide range of problems, whether the next disease presents with respiratory symptoms, as influenza does, or whether it causes diarrhea, or whether it just causes fever. We have to have people on the ground with a range of expertise and laboratory capabilities to test for a range of things. That's important for the military labs in order to pick up new things and also to serve their host countries. They're working in areas that are facing a wide range of problems, malaria, dengue, influenza, other things. So to do good service for them, they have to have broad-based capabilities. And so what we're describing are labs like that, that are well-staffed, have a lot of diagnostic capabilities, work with host countries and the WHO, and we have to locate these in areas where there are gaps in WHO's global network. You know, if human-to-human transmission of influenza began in many places in Africa or in rural Asia or in parts of South America, we probably would not catch it in time, and it could become a pandemic. And so we have to look very carefully at these areas to prioritize the regions and also look at feasibility. You know, it's hard to build a lab where there's very little public health infrastructure. So we'd have to balance need, feasibility, and work together across countries to do this.
Are you saying then that some of the places that where the a pandemic might potentially break out can't afford to have a lab there?
That's right. These countries that lack basic public health infrastructure would not be able to build and operate such a facility. And what we've suggested in our proposal is that even to ask one country, one wealthy country, to fund a network of labs or even perhaps an individual lab on its own is a lot to ask. It also brings risks if there is one sponsor for such a facility. And if relations worsen with this one country or if there are strategic changes in this country's vision, then we may see support for this facility decline. But if we get a coalition of countries and non-governmental sponsors to work on these facilities, then we'll be buffered from some of those fluctuations.
Where do you think that the money, the funds to pay for this network of labs might come from?
I think we have to look primarily to wealthy countries and convince them to recognize that emerging infectious diseases, especially influenza with its potential for a pandemic, but other diseases as well, are problems that they need to deal with. And pandemic influenza is certainly a wake-up call as we see these avian influenza outbreaks occurring in Asia, in Europe, and Africa. And we're seeing countries starting to recognize that this is something that could affect them. And so I think we need to take advantage of this moment that we have now and use it to take some of this funding that countries have already committed. We heard a few minutes ago about the billions of dollars committed at the pledging conference in Beijing. In the U.S., Congress has allocated several billion dollars extra this year for the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Defense, and other agencies to prepare for pandemic influenza. So we're certainly at a time where wealthy countries who could do this have recognized that there is a problem that could face them. So we need to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Lieutenant Jean-Paul Chrétien, Coordinator of Overseas Research Laboratories for the Department of Defense Global Emerging Infectious Surveillance and Response System at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Silver Spring. Does the Army have the it's a long name for your organization. Is there a laboratory or system at Walter Reed which is a surveillance and keeping it, you know, its ears and eyes open?
Well, yes, actually, the central hub or the headquarters of this network of overseas labs is at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, and this is our coordinating center. Walter Reed of Army Institute of Research, or RARE, also does research on diseases of military importance. And something that I should point out is that our organization, GEIS, which we prefer to Geezers, which would be the acronym, but GEIS coordinates efforts in the military health system as well. So from our central hub, we have partners working at the military's overseas labs and also at domestic military laboratories and military treatment facilities, all to track emerging infectious diseases of importance to the military or of national interest.
Well, you would think any outbreak is of national interest and important to the military, certainly also. Do you coordinate? I mean, are the militaries of the world doing the coordinations now like you are, more than the civilian governments?
Well, it's a good point about needing to coordinate between military and civilian for several reasons. One is that in the U.S., many people who are called on to serve currently in operations in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere are people that are being pulled from civilian life to do this, and they will return to their civilian lives and to civilian treatment facilities. And exposures that they may get to infectious diseases overseas, they can bring back with them and mm-hmm. to their families and to other facilities. And, you know, for influenza, if we have an influenza pandemic, that is going to affect military populations and civilian populations. It is not going to be restricted to one, and so we need to work together. And so one of the things that my organization, GICE, has been doing is working closely with the CDC, both at the central office level and on the ground in some of these countries where we have overseas laboratories, and with WHO. And so we have a military liaison officer at the World Health Organization, and our overseas labs work very closely with WHO as well.
Well, I have just a few seconds left. Lieutenant, do you think that this laboratory network will actually be built and can be built?
Yeah, I'm optimistic that it can be. And I say that because we've seen a lot of money committed by wealthy countries to address the threat of pandemic influenza, a lot of money that's going into building capacity overseas. And what we're suggesting is just a way to channel that money into a model that's worked for us.
Lieutenant, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Myra. My pleasure.
Lieutenant Jean-Paul Chrétien is MD and coordinator of Overseas Research Laboratories at Walter Reed Hospital. We're going to take a break and come back and change gears and talk about the moons of Pluto. So stay with us. We'll be right back.